Escape from Cubicle 17, Episode 6. I recorded a number of interviews at FenCon last September. I've already posted my interview with FenCon's co-chair, Tim Mullen. Well, now I bring you my first interview with one of the guests in attendance, the amazing and talented author and filker, William Mark Simmons. Welcome to Escape from Cubicle 17. This is Chris Marley, your podcast host, and I'm recording live at FenCon 4, and today I have author and filker, William Mark Simmons, although some people call him Wim.
You can call me Mark. Actually, you know, my parents called me Mark. I didn't realize I had a first name till I went to grade school, and they called me by my first name. And I went home and told my parents, why didn't you tell me this? And of course, having to deal with the bureaucracies thereafter, I started signing my first name in an abbreviated manner. Mm-hmm. And when I began writing professionally, that's just how I did it. And I tell my friends, so people won't confuse me with that hack, Dan Simmons.
Ah, okay.
Who's stolen all my Hugos.
Well, you have been nominated for you've been a Compton Crook Award finalist. And let's see. Oh, yes, it was your first novel. And it also made one of the Locust Best Lists in 1991.
So that's right.
And also, it looks like your background, the reason why he has such a wonderful voice is that he's also a broadcaster.
That's right. I work in radio. I have worked in television. Mm-hmm. And hosted my own cable variety show. And for a year, I was a musical variety host and producer. And as producer, I used my power to fire myself as host after a year so that I could hire myself as director and have ultimate power as producer-director.
Well, that's excellent. Now, where are you broadcasting out of?
I am now the music director for Radio Kansas. We have three stations and cover about half of the state in Kansas. And I'm on the classical morning host for classical music in the state of Kansas as well.
Now, I've noticed a lot of the public radio stations also do streaming audio on the internet. And do they also do some streaming audio for any of your shows?
We did. Unfortunately, the legislation that has evolved in the recent years has made it too expensive and complicated for many stations to continue to do that. Mm-hmm. without spending a lot of time getting into the whys and wherefores. It's just become too difficult and annoying and expensive per listener for many stations to keep that up.
Oh, that's too bad, because there's a couple of public radio shows that I like to listen to that I can't get in Tulsa, and I have to listen to them streaming. So.
Yes, I know, and we used to do that. We could spend about half the podcast talking about that.
Well, we can save that for another podcast.
Okay.
That's the nice thing about podcasting is that it's, you know, basically radio on demand is mm-hmm. what it is. And, of course, you can subscribe to it, and we hope you subscribe to this show.
Well, we hope that as this sort of thing mm-hmm. becomes more ubiquitous, the FCC and the industry will make this more reasonable for everyone to do.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Now, what we're going to do now is we're going to start talking about Mark's writings, because he is, in addition to being a filker, and we'll explain what filking is after we talk about his writing, and he's been writing, publishing fiction since the 90s, and although he doesn't have a large body of work, they are very high quality. Now, there is a series, and I asked you earlier how to pronounce it, and it's Chaitê.
Yes.
Although it's spelled a little differently, it's Chris Chaitê Half-Life Series. You've got four books out, One Foot in the Grave, Dead on My Feet, Habeas Corpses, and the most recent one, Dead Easy. And looking at the name, the Half-Life series, what's the basic premise behind the series?
Well, actually, I originally kind of wanted to call it the Almost a Vampire series. And I was never a big fan of vampires, and I perhaps shouldn't admit that. And somehow, after all the Anne Rice stuff back in the 80s and 90s, and all the vampire movies and the big, huge, it's the literary genre that will not die, or stay dead anyway. I was reading an article about how in every culture, in every country, there is a vampire mythos, but not necessarily the East European one, and that they don't all die with a stake in their heart and the head decapitation. I thought, what if you ran across a vampire and did the stake through the heart, decapitate them, and it didn't kill them? They got up and ran off. Well, now you're faced with a long list of different kinds of vampires, and you've got to catch it again and start going down the list. And from there in grew the first story, One Foot in the Grave. And with horror, there's always not just a suspension of disbelief, but almost a perverse sense of humor that we've seen Hitchcock and some of the other masters bring to the genre. And I was tempted to write a story, which I did, mm-hmm. about a man who's thrust into the middle of horrific circumstances and only surviving by bringing a little bit of a sense of humor to horrific circumstances. Chris Chaitet, his last name actually is taken from Elizabeth Bathory's ancestral castle in Budapest and in that region, Elizabeth Bathory being actually the historical figure on which Bram Stoker based the Dracula novel more than Dracula himself. She was the countess who believed that bathing in blood, the blood of virgins, would keep her young. And it worked for about 10 years, and then it didn't work as well, so she decided that noble blood would work better, and that's what was her downfall.
Yeah. It's okay.
But I digress.
It's okay if it's peasants, but if it's one of your fellow nobles.
Yeah, that's when the nobles stepped in and said, up against the wall, red to the neck, mother. And so One Foot in the Grave was the first novel in the series in which Chris, all of the books are based on a template. Mm-hmm. And the template is that each book deals with a classic horror trope, and each one has a science fiction technological issue at hand. For instance, in the first book, if those who are familiar with the vampire mythos know that people are turned into vampires because they are not only bitten, mm-hmm. but they then drink the blood of a vampire. So there is blood and saliva involved. In the hypothesis of the book, there is a combinant supervirus that transforms the living into the undead. Virus A is in the saliva, virus B is in the blood. And since Chris is not bitten, but only is contaminated by a blood exchange, mm-hmm. he only has one of the two viruses and not the one that most people get when they're only bitten. So it's like being a little bit pregnant. He's got one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel, so to speak. And so he lives in this twilight world between the living and the undead. And it creates all sorts of complications in his life. And the first book actually deals more with the mummy mythos mm-hmm. than although there are vampires and other denizens of the night. And it deals with his trying to adjust to the fact that there really is this twilight world out there and how there are creatures both of the unseen world and the government and other people who are out for his strangely mutated blood and how he has to survive and persevere by his wits and his capabilities against forces far greater than his own.
Okay. One of the things about series is a lot of times people think that they have to start at the beginning, although, yes, you want to sell every book in the series. Yeah. Your most recent one is Dead Easy, which just came out this year in hardcover. Mm-hmm. Is that something that people can approach without having to have read the other books?
That's always the challenge in a series is for the new readers to pick up the new book and not have any idea from the last book. So I always try to put the ground under the new readers' feet without boring the old readers and to not give too much away. In the new book, the opening scene, Chris is in a mental asylum where his psychiatrist is trying to convince him this idea that he's a half vampire and all this stuff is all a mental delusion. And so for a therapeutic session, they're going through this whole thing that he's had a psychotic break. So you get a little bit of catch up while the old readers are going, what the heck's going on? Maybe this was all a dream, so to speak, until you find out that he's been captured by elves and there's this whole what the heck is going on now sort of thing. And again, as I said, each one's got a template, something different. Mm-hmm. In the second book, we deal with zombies and voodoo. The third is the Frankenstein mythos. Habeas Corpus, originally I wanted to be Born with the Dead, was mm-hmm. going to be the title because of the T.S. Eliot poem. We die with the dying, see they depart. We are born with the dead, see they return. But there was a title issue. And then In Dead Easy, of course, I proposed the title and the book to my publisher about over a year before Katrina, saying that in this one, which deals with the Cthulhu Lovecraftian universe, a killer hurricane comes in and puts New Orleans underwater like Atlantis. And we deal with Cthulhu and the elder gods. And they didn't get back to me until after Katrina said, "Oh, how fast can you write this?" So Dead Easy, of course, referring to the Big Easy. Deals with that, and we have elves and the great old ones, and sort of a riff on Gidget meets the creature from the Black Lagoon sort of thing. It's and the trick in each of the books is a balancing act between humor and horror. Not that these people are cardboard cutouts, because there is some very funny stuff. Chris has to deal with these creatures in ways that nobody else does, you know, and he carries a silver loaded Glock, which he's never able to use. Stakes, nah. He takes one vampire out with a tanning bed. In the book I'm working on now, it's a laser pointer. He has to make do with what he has. And in the first book, part of the repercussions of his half turning is that he's in an automobile accident and wakes up on a slab in the morgue. And you find out about this through hypnotic regression when they're trying to find out what were the circumstances that led to his current condition. And it's a very funny scene as they regress him through hypnosis, and he wakes up on the slab and just scares the bejesus out of the morgue attendant and the custodian, and it's quite funny until he turns and looks and sees the bodies of his wife and daughter on the next tables. And it's that juxtaposition of humor and horror throughout the books that is a delicate tightrope walk. So there have been people who occasionally come to me and say, "Would my child like this?" And I have to say, these are not children's books. There's a lot of humor in the books, because there is this, again, this laughing in the face of darkness, but they're not books for children.
Right. Yeah, a lot of times humor comes out of pain.
Exactly.
And so sometimes people don't necessarily see the connection between horror and humor.
Well, comedians do, because they go out there and they talk about, "Boy, I killed tonight on stage," or if they didn't do well, they said, "Boy, I just died out there."
And so Dead Easy, of course, is set in a New Orleans destroyed by a hurricane, or actually underwater now. So did it, I guess there were some supernatural elements too. We're not going to spoil it for too many people, but.
And there are repercussions at the end of this book that will have to be dealt with in the next book. We wrap things up in each book, and each book stands alone, but there is a progression of events. So for people who read the series, it's not like there's a giant reset button that's pushed and everything goes back to the way it was. There is a progression of relationships and events and how things are affected. So while each book is a standalone, there is a progression in the lives of the characters and how they are affected, and things do not return to the way they were.
Now, Dead Easy, who puts Dead Easy out?
Bain is my publisher with this series. They're the imprint, science fiction-wise, of Simon & Schuster. And One Foot in the Grave, of course, is in paperback. It was the first in the series.
Right.
Since then, Dead on My Feet, Habeas Corpses, and Dead Easy are all out in hardcover. Dead on My Feet and Habeas Corpses are also in paperback. Dead Easy, of course, is new enough that it is not yet out in paperback.
So it'll probably be like 2008 before it comes out in paperback.
Yeah. I don't know what the schedule is yet.
Well, you don't have to wait that long, folks. You can go and buy it now. I'm sure he'd appreciate that. Now, one of the other things is, I think we've covered enough of this material we don't want to spoil it for people. We want them to be intrigued to go and check out your works. Now, there's another one. Another chapbook, actually, it's called Pathfinders 1, and I was looking at your website, and you have a little bit of information about it, and I was intrigued by the idea. What was your philosophy behind doing Pathfinders?
Well, you know, the seven books I have out so far, the three in the Dreamland Chronicles series, which is Misty Lackey described it as a cyber laugh. And it sort of does for computer gaming what the Half-Life Chronicles does for horror. They're all humorous, serious literature, and got me the title of Master of Twisted Humor's Fantasy, or what they call it. I was trying to break out of the mold of just doing the humorous stuff, and I started writing something experimentally, and it started off as a prologue in which, and I hate to say this, I don't want to say this, admit to it, but I guess here's your scoop. I wrote the prologue in present tense.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, it worked so well, which is a big no-no, they say, you know, literally or literarily to do, that I thought, let me see how long I can sustain this. And I took it on the reading circuit at the conventions in mm-hmm. the early 90s. And the audiences responded so well to it. In fact, most readers and most listeners don't recognize it as present tense. The smoke and mirrors, I might say, I guess you would say, work so well that I've continued the process. And I took it to my agent, who didn't want to do anything with it.
Right.
She said, oh, no, this isn't your stuff. This isn't what you're doing. So I put it on the shelf and concentrated on my long-form fiction. Mm-hmm. And then I was approached a year or so back by Yard Dog Press for another project. And at that point, I wasn't ready to go with this project, but I said, hey, I have something you might be interested in. They looked at it and said, wow, we'd love to do this. We'd like to do, we're going to offer you a book contract. And I said, I don't want a book contract. I'd like to do this in serialized form as mm-hmm. a series of chapbooks. And they were very enthusiastic about that because it matched what I was doing in the reading rooms, presenting it in an episodic manner. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a piece of mythic epic storytelling. And the style in which I'm doing it gives it that mythic epic sort of feel. Rather than distancing the reader, it draws them in a way that gives it an otherworldly sort of tone. And so what we're doing is we are releasing a chapbook, one or two a year,
mm-hmm.
and letting the story unfold organically. This also gives the readers a chance for input as the story unfolds. It's a little bit like what Dickens used to do, and when mm-hmm. his books would come out in the newspapers every month or so, or every 6 to 8 weeks. And Stephen King, I guess, did initially with The Green Mile, some others. And also, a footnote to this, we talked about this before we turned the mics on.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a plan at this point to eventually release this as a final bound book form. I'm not saying we won't, but at this point there's not a plan to do that. This story will unfold in its own format, and it may be longer than one volume. It may be shorter.
Mm-hmm.
It may come out at a volume and a half, but we're not going to say, we're not going to stretch it to fit one or two volumes. We're not going to condense it. It's going to unfold organically at the pace and at the size it should be. And again, I look to readers in the process to weigh in.
Well, that's excellent. Yeah, that's now, of course, you can go to yarddogpress.com and purchase the book directly from them. Or it's probably not something you're going to find on a, you know, like in a Borders or Barnes & Nobles, but you'll be able to get it from Yard Dog Press. And also, a lot of dealers will probably carry it at conventions.
At the conventions. And eventually, it's not yet, as we sit here and speak, it's not yet available on Amazon.com, mm-hmm. but it should be down the road.
Oh, excellent. Well, I think we've covered your writing fairly thoroughly, and one of the things is, you know, I've always heard of Mark, and I've known him more from the Filk circles. I heard him as a Filker, and first of all, we need to probably explain to people what Filk is and where that term comes from.
Well, Filk, oh, there's so many ways to answer that question. Back in the 20s, 30s, way back in the mists of time,
mm-hmm.
for science fiction conventions, a gathering of fans got together late in the evening at one of the early conventions and decided to have some folk music and brought their guitars and other instruments. And the program book had a typo in it and transposed the O for an I, and it came out filk instead of folk music. And since then, the tradition has been for music at science fiction conventions that usually is themed for the science fiction or fantasy or any other genre literature to be called filk music. It can be humorous, it can be serious, it can be funny, it can be beautiful, it can be raucous, it can be anything. It can be rap. It takes any format of music you can imagine. It's been filked.
Okay. Well, I think probably rather than just describe it, I think it would help the listeners if you could give an example of a song.
Oh, gosh. Okay, a verse of, you know, a lot of filkers will take an existing song and change it. Let's take the old Tennessee Ernie Ford, 16 Tons.
Okay.
And here's an example, first verse of 16K. Some people say a man is made out of mud. An android's made out of synthetic blood. Plasticeel flesh and stainless steel bone. A positronic brain with no erogenous zones. You load 16K. What do you scan? Another day older for a synthetic man. Dr. A, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I loan my soul to the company clone.
Well, that's excellent. I thought about
I couldn't
snapping.
Remember the words for a moment. It's been a while.
Well, so that's a good example. I thought about snapping along with it, but I'm not good at keeping time. So, of course, listeners can go out there and do that themselves. Now, if, you know, so Filk's been around in fandom for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I guess probably is, what is it that attracts you to Filk?
Oh, well, gee, I'm an old folky, and, geez, I used to play in bars and coffee houses, and I just like music, and I love listening to other people do it. And one of the first science fiction conventions I went to, I was wandering around late one evening and ran across some other musicians and ended up sitting behind a bunch of people going, "What's going on? What is this?" And and got pulled in by a community of people who like music and got coerced into doing some of my own, and since then got talked into doing some things, and it's a nice way as an author to promote some of my own material,
right?
And it's fun. It's something to do late at night when everyone else when all the weaklings go off to bed.
Yeah, I have sat in on a few Filk circles. It definitely is a lot of fun, and
I've heard rumors that your wife has been seduced to the dark side of Filk.
Yes, I know some people have. They kind of look at Filk as kind of like, oh no, they got sucked into it. They look on it as in horror. But fandom offers so many things for different people, and I think that's how a lot of people find Filk, is they're walking through the hallways looking for something to do, and then they hear this song that pulls them into the room. And usually there are people in there that, you know, they're singing their songs. I mean, I know some are just, you know, new lyrics to old tunes, but some of them are also original compositions as well.
Yes.
And now, so you can find him, of course, you can find Filking Circles at conventions, but and for people, a lot of times before the internet, you know, people made photocopies of the songs and they handed them to each other so they could, and they have these big, thick books of sheets, you know, where they copied stuff down. Now, I guess the internet makes it a lot easier to find those Filk songs, because, you know, people can publish them on the internet, or at least the lyrics, and say it's sung to this particular tune.
Right.
Have you found that the internet has, do you think it's helped increase interest in Filking or raise its awareness?
That's a good question. I hadn't recently explored the internet, I hadn't explored the internet until recently, and it had been helpful because I had lost a chunk of music or lyrics in the course of a move and had to recover some things. And recently when I was looking for some things, I was able to recover some of the lyrics by going to the internet. So there is stuff out there. Of course, it raises all kinds of copyright questions.
Yes.
And but, you know, there's a lot of people out there who compose things and then just throw it out there for everyone to share in. And actually, a little earlier I'd mentioned that Yard Dog had approached me for a project, and really what they had approached me to do was to publish a booklet of my own Philk lyrics. And I just haven't been ready to do that yet. I've just been a little busy, and maybe a little bit farther down the road I'll do that.
Well, hopefully when you listen to this podcast again, it'll remind you. Maybe I ought to, you know, go ahead.
Maybe I ought to do that.
Yeah. Now, one of the things is I've noticed that in Philk circles is that there seems to be a certain etiquette to how people perform, because someone who is new to it, they get intrigued and say, well, I'd like to sing too, or they're not sure how to participate. So when someone who comes to a Philk circle for the first time, one, I guess, is how does the I imagine there's different rules depending on where you are. But you might give some basics, you know, basic guidelines for what people should look for.
That's difficult, because I just came up here from a panel talking about that very issue and about the various styles and kinds of Philk circles. And there's bardic and there's chaos, and there's different kinds of etiquette and different ways in which to pass the circle around. And we could spend another hour talking about that alone. Chaos tends to be a room full of people in which whoever jumps in next gets the opportunity, and then the bardic circle means that you go around a circle, and whoever's turn it is next takes that turn. There's poker chip or clothespin Philk, where people are given a certain number of clothespins or poker chips. They throw it into the circle saying, I'm going to do my song, or I'm going to take my turn to choose someone else to sing, or this is the song I want. Who wants to do it? Sometimes there's someone in the circle or the room who's designated to sort of direct traffic. You know, I think the best Philk experiences I've had have been at conventions where there's more than one room and the tide can flow back and forth between two or more rooms, so that the shy have an opportunity to go where they're not as pressured, and the experienced people have a chance to go where they're more comfortable, and you see the flow of audience and performers move about to find the energy that they need. It's a dynamic process, and no Philk performance or circle is the same. And of course, the best conventions for this are the ones that program for it. There are conventions that allocate very little space or time for it. There are conventions that have Philk concerts by those performers who are better known, perhaps more talented, or at least better recognized, who are given rooms to perform for a half hour or an hour throughout the day. And so there's a wide array of opportunities and possibilities. So when you're looking for convention opportunities, you might look ahead at the programming and see which conventions accommodate more Philk programming. Some accommodate a lot, some accommodate very little.
Well, I've noticed that FanCon does definitely accommodates a lot.
They're very Philk-oriented, and it's a great place to come for music.
And matter of fact, you're going to have a concert a little bit later on this afternoon.
Actually, I am, and I'm going to premiere some new material.
Oh, excellent.
And my Muggle wife is going to perform with me.
Well, that's good. So probably the best advice is just to, go to Philk Circle, sit and listen, and then just kind of get a feel for it and just ask how does this work? Because, you know, you said the rules vary from Philk Circle to Philk Circle.
Yes, they do. And there's all kinds of – it's just like if you were to go out to a coffee house or a bar, the different – quality or kinds of musicianship and types of music you would hear is going to vary as well. There is just some wonderful music at the different Philk performances. And then, of course, you hit some new people or some inexperienced musicians. And it's like different artists and writers. You hit some rooms where you think, I'm not too sure. And you come back a year or two later and hear that same person perform. And wow, what a difference.
Well, one thing I have noticed in attending a few Philk circles is that a lot of times they tend to be very tolerant of newbies, because, you know, some people can't carry a tune in a bucket, and they'll go ahead and let them perform because, you know, you got to try your wings sometime.
Well, you know, it's the dichotomy between Philking and fan fiction is that there are fan fiction authors who go on to become professional writers and even award-winning authors and New York Times best-selling authors. But at conventions, you usually don't give them rooms to read their fan fiction out loud and perform it. But folk singers, you do. So, you know, if that was the case, there would be a lot more of an attitude against fan fiction at conventions than there is for those who are sort of anti-filk. And you run across that crowd occasionally. But there are just unbelievably professional caliber musicians who do what we call filk. Or as Tom Smith, who's one of the great, great filkers of our time, says, I don't say that I'm a filker because to some people because that sets up a certain connotation in their mind. I say I'm a humorous folk rocker. And that gives them a more realistic idea of what he does without changing who he is or what he does. But he has to work against certain stereotypes for some people.
Yeah, I've heard the Bonhoeffs perform, and they're excellent. We're getting close to running out of time, and I was hoping that we might get you to perform a song. If you have time, let's do it. If not, then maybe we can record it later.
So. Okay, well, let me try something that I had just pulled out. I haven't done this in several years, but I made a last-minute decision. I'm going to do this in the next hour for my concert.
Okay.
It's something I wrote... the words up for, you know, we talked about how you, and let me pull my guitar on while I'm talking.
Okay.
If I bump things a little bit, I don't know. Oops. Make that part of the reality of the performance. One of the things that we sometimes do when we filk is we, some authors who filk use it as a way of promotion. This is, I wrote the words a little bit for Chris Chaitay. And his experience upon awakening and what he goes through in the first in the series of books, One Foot in the Grave, as almost a vampire, a guy who's kind of caught between two worlds. Let's see if I'm still tuned. The air conditioner sometimes throws the strings off. Darkness, my loved ones are gone. The table is cold beneath me. My shadow is missing, the sun is too bright. Undone so completely. I shun the kindness of long-toothed strangers whose cold embraces may send me to hell. So I walk alone through the halls of forever and ever and ever in dread. One foot in the grave and one hand in the light. I know not what fate now awaits me. Humans by day and the children of night, they hunt me and hound me to slay me. My long-haired lover and long-dead master are only allies of which I'm need a little more practice.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but that was excellent.
Well, thank you.
Well, Mark, I think we've just about run out of time, and I really appreciate you performing and joining me here on Escape from Cubicle 17.
Well, thanks. Thanks for the time.
And so now I return you to your regularly scheduled cubicle, because science fiction isn't just about escape. It's about seeing the world differently.